In recent years, we've gotten far too accustomed to describing every administration action as unprecedented. Along the way, our conversation partner has often been Greg LaBelle, political management expert and veteran of several presidential campaigns. To make sure we don't gloss over the importance of the return to competence we're seeing in the nation's capital, I'm happy to welcome Greg back to State of Belief Radio. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jack. It's nice to see you again.
You too. You too. I fully recognize enormous challenges are in place for anyone who wants to lead this country. But is it fair to say normalcy has returned to our nation's capital with surprising speed?
No. there are intense efforts to make that happen, but I think that what we are witnessing, particularly up on the Hill, is an ongoing debate, an ongoing fight among numbers of sort of factions. We have these two major factions within the Republican Party, the Trump wing, which oddly enough, or maybe not oddly enough, still exists. And those in party leadership who are trying to break away from that. And that is spilling over into the debate about bipartisanship that President Biden started with his inaugural address and his efforts at bipartisanship. So no, I don't think anything has been resolved yet. I was on a Zoom call last night with, among other people, Adam Kinzinger, who is one of the most vocal sort of people in the "let's stop talking about Donald Trump" wing of the party. You know, he said this part of the conversation. He says, "I've already got somebody running against me in my reelection campaign." So now this whole thing is by no means resolved.
I'd love to get your take on the moves the Biden-Harris administration has taken thus far, not just on this subject of bipartisanship, but in general.
Well, again, this is one of those interesting things that we sort of get wrapped around the axle on everything, because, as I said, the president in his inaugural address and in other statements since the election has talked about bipartisanship and working together and unity and so on and so forth. And then the question becomes, well, what is unity? How do we define unity? And it seems that that has become a cottage industry in Washington, with Republicans saying, well, unity means we get to tell you what to do. And if you don't agree with it, you're not living up to your commitment to unity. So there's a real effort, I think, but at the same time, this administration has taken on some very serious issues, not the least of which, obviously, is the COVID-19 situation, which we've seen very little done by the previous administration, and they're really trying to make up time. So this administration has to make some decisions. Are we going to wait to try to get Republicans on board with some of the things we want to do, or are we just going to do them? And I think that President Biden learned as vice president with the ACA that waiting created more problems than it was probably worth to think they could bring Republicans on board, who never came on board eventually anyway. And so I think their decision is, we've got to do this. And so they've made that decision, it seems, to move ahead and do it. And that's before we even get into the whole issue of nominees for cabinet positions.
Yeah, let's talk about nominees. It seems the wheels are turning again, but there's still an awful lot of sneaky acting appointments to sort out, as I understand it. Is that right?
Oh, leftovers. Yes. The Trump folks made a real effort to implant some of their folks in positions. Now, a number of them can be removed, and the Biden administration has been doing that. And in fact, just this week, President Biden appointed three new members of the Postal Commission, which is an important step for those of us who really want to see Mr. DeJoy find a new job, preferably in a prison workshop. The bigger issue, I think, is just the refusal on the part of Republicans to what I would say is play fair with regard to new nominees for cabinet and just sub-cabinet positions. And there are some who are seeing some issues around their focus on women and minorities. They seem to be the ones who are running into the most trouble. I'm a particular fan of Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who is a nominee for Secretary of Interior, first Native American to hold that position, which I think is an extremely important step in the right direction. There's some real challenges faced there. And this is the slowest process for nominees being approved, I think, in many years. And, you know, part of that was, you know, we couldn't even get an agreement on how to organize the Senate out of Mitch McConnell way back when. So that sort of slowed things down. So this is a significant and ongoing problem for the administration.
So let's talk about the slow way that this transition has taken place. Is it your sense that this was just sort of Trump-style theatrics that have spilled over into this new administration? Or is it an expression of an ongoing extreme partisanship that is threatening what used to be the more solemn aspects of a functioning democracy?
I think, Jack, that it is the latter more than the former, but maybe a little bit mix of the two. I mean, this is a point where I feel like just turned into a cranky old man and I'm going to do that. You know, I remember the days when, and I do remember the days when a new president of the Congress, whoever was over sitting on the Hill with a new president, generally, and I'd say 9 times out of 10, their response to cabinet nominees was, a new president is entitled to put together his team.
Right.
And that was the mindset. And people say, well, this one may not be perfect, but, you know, the president is entitled to put together the team that makes sense for this administration. And that's gone. That simply doesn't, that's not part of the equation anymore. And I think that's really unfortunate, because these aren't felons who are being nominated here. I mean, these are people with which members of Congress have some policy disagreements. Well, of course they're going to have policy disagreements. They belong to a different party. So that's the cranky old man in me response to that. It's a sort of, you know, why can't we just sort of do this the way we used to do it and let the president have his cabinet and let them sink or swim on their own merits instead of this? But everything seems to be now a battle for the soul of fill in the blank. And that's sort of where we find ourselves. And it's very distressing. Yeah.
People are coming to Washington now to work in this new administration. Are you observing a resurgence in young people's interest in coming to Washington for internships and to work for the federal government?
I don't know specifically about that, although it wouldn't surprise me. But what I am seeing, I have been a fan of, as you know, Jack, of the importance of young people in politics for most of my life, having been involved in two areas, primarily in electoral politics and in academia as a teacher. So I have been fortunate to be able to surround myself with young people in both in campaigns and in teaching situations for many, many years. And I'm a big fan of young people and what they can do. And I think we are seeing a real resurgence among young people in an interest in politics, which seemed to have faded for a while, even almost, I think, a fear or loathing of politics. And there are new organizations sort of popping up that I have great hope for. One of them is the Millennial Action Project, which is a relatively new organization, which is focusing specifically on that millennial group in terms of reaching out to figure out how to repair our democratic processes. So there's a lot going on, and I find it extremely exciting that young people seem to have found their way back into an interest in politics. And I think it's directly related to the presidential election, and maybe even more so to the runoff elections in Georgia. Young people are feeling empowered, and I'm very, very happy about that.
Are you worried that they're going to be subsumed under this atmosphere of hyper-partisanship that you just described?
It's always possible. And I think that's one of the major things that they have to fight against. And I know that the Millennial Action Project, the one that I mentioned, I know that that's one of their concerns. They're trying to keep both sides involved and become truly bipartisan in how they approach issues. To some extent, the Interfaith Alliance has often faced challenges along those lines with sort of keeping people with disparate views involved. And it's a real challenge, and it takes a lot of work and constant alertness to the possibilities of that happening.
So let's move from Washington, D.C. to Orlando, Florida for a minute. This weekend, the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, was featuring former President Donald Trump. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be one of their speakers. Do you expect he'll try some wild stunt to regain the media attention that he's got to be sorely missing right now?
I don't think he needs to. I say that with some sadness. I think the fact that he's going to be speaking at CPAC is going to be enough to draw the media's attention. They will report it on it in what some shape or form. I expect what we will see is the same old whining about the witch hunt, about I didn't lose the election, I actually won the election in a landslide. We may see the same old litany of grievances that seems to be where he's stuck. He will undoubtedly make some allusions to how he will run strong candidates against anyone in the Congress who dared to stand up to him in the recent impeachment process. What I'm hoping is that this is the last. He will get attention for this speech because CPAC always gets attention. It's sort of the nature of this thing. But I'm hoping that once that speech comes and goes, that we can really try to forget about him and let him do whatever it is he needs to or can do, and we can go on with our lives.
I think it's so important not to prematurely say mission accomplished. That didn't work out so well once before.
Right.
How dangerous do you think covert resistance and hostility to the new administration may be, both inside the government and beyond?
Again, I think that the opposition to the current administration, to the government as it exists now, is built in to the Trumpies, to what they're about. I think that's a given. And I think that we will continue to see that along the way. As I said, I think we're seeing it to some extent in the reactions of some members of Congress to some of these cabinet position nominees now. That will continue. The hopeful sign I see is that Joe Biden, and as you know, early on, I was not a Joe Biden supporter during the primary, but I recognize and applaud his capability, and I'm glad that he's where he is because with the years of experience that he has behind him, I think he is able to navigate this better than maybe almost anyone as president at this particular time. So I'm encouraged by that. He recognizes the value for most of us in not waking up every morning and wondering what the president said before I woke up this morning or after I went to bed last night. And I think that there's a lot of support for a presidency like that right now. But that takes some time to sort of shake out. So I think the administration is taking the right approach. We've got work to do. We've got policy to talk about, and that's what we're going to do. And y'all just got to kind of get in line and join us on this. And I think that's sort of where they take. And he surrounded himself with some remarkable people. Jen Psaki is press secretary. It just blows me away every time I see her. Partly, of course, is the bar was so low when she stepped into the job. But even aside from that, she is remarkable in terms of the level of respect and knowledge and capability that she brings to that podium every day. And she's just one example of that.
Greg, you've worked on a number of presidential campaigns. You've taught political management over the years. In what universe do some of the former president's loudest defenders, enablers, and apologists get to go on with business as usual with no consequences for trampling the norms and standards, for putting their colleagues in mortal danger, and for betraying truth itself? Do they get away with that?
Unfortunately, you asked what universe that exists, and unfortunately, it appears to be the universe that the rest of us all share with them right now. Should they get away with it? No, of course not. Will they get away with it? I think the jury is still out on that. I think that I know that there are lots of investigations that are going on. And you touch on something that's of concern to me. And this is why I want to stop talking about Donald Trump specifically. Trump is Trump, and he's going to have his own set of problems right now, financial, legal, and everything else. But what you just said is really the key question. What do we do about all these people who enabled this and are now going to try to sort of shift the focus as they feel necessary to come across as somehow on the right side of this, however that's defined, especially the Ted Cruzes and Josh Hawleys of the world who plan to run for president as they keep their fingers up in the wind and try to figure out where they need to be on these issues. So I am cautiously optimistic that the investigations that are going on, and there are many investigations I'm sure that are going on that we don't know about, that are looking at things that need to be looked at. And I just my hope and my fond expectation is that we will find ways to do this, because that is really one of the big challenges that we face. We hear Republicans say, well, let's just move on. You know, you want to unify. Well, let's just move on and forget. We can't forget this. I mean, the example is that's been given, and I don't think it's too far off. Is the example of South Africa with the truth with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that came about. We need to figure out what the systemic issues are here that brought us to this point, and we need to face them.
Yeah.
And that's our challenge.
Greg LaBelle is Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University, where he ran several popular academic programs. He's a veteran of several political campaigns, presidential campaigns in particular. Greg has held leadership positions at prominent organizations, first among them, Interfaith Alliance. Greg, I know things aren't going to stay calm for long, so I'm glad we could have this conversation today on State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad too. It's nice to see you, Jack. Take care.
Before we go, it was moving to watch President Biden and Vice President Harris pay solemn tribute to the 500,000 lives lost to the pandemic in this country. 500,000 deaths is a number none of us is equipped to truly grasp. But more and more of us are being impacted personally. And this week, death came to the Interfaith Alliance family. Bishop Joseph Grabowski was an active and energetic member of our board of directors, an inspiring faith leader, and a man with boundless plans for the future. He was also a dear friend. Founder of the Institute on Religion and Public Policy, nominated several times for the Nobel Peace Prize, prolific writer, traveler, and advisor to leaders around the globe. In literally just hours, in the first part of Wednesday, Joe was stricken and then felled by the consequences of this horrific disease. He was just 46 years old. We mourn together with his wife, Tracy, family, and friends. May his memory be for a blessing. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and to be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join Welton Gaddy next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.